Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If you'd like to participate in this program, you're welcome to do so. Our number is 877-300-7645. It is toll-free. And as we typically do, we're going to move back to Yahweh's presentation in his Torah. There's probably nothing in the entire universe more worth exploring, more valuable for us to explore than his covenant. His introduction of himself as it relates to his covenant, the reasons that he created his covenant, what he's offering through his covenant, what he's expecting of us relative to the covenant. I'm a big fan of exploring the nature of life and exploring the great outdoors and exploring the universe. But when it comes to the thrill of discovery and the benefits associated with discovery, nothing beats examining the words that Yahweh used relative to his covenant. This statement reads, "And I will grow, I will be fruitful, I will flourish with you in the extreme and to the greatest extent possible." This was Wah Parah, Eth, Ba Maod Maod. The Hebrew verb parah was written with a hyphal stem. Very powerful insights. We spent a considerable amount of time yesterday talking about the hyphal stem and what it implies when God is speaking to us. What I'm going to share with you is germane when God is speaking to us, because when God is speaking to us, he's the subject of the sentence. When he's speaking to us, we are the object of the sentence. So subject, verb, object. The hyphal stem modifies the implications of the verb such that we are to look at the action of the verb causing with the subject, who is Yahweh, causing the object, which is us, to participate in the benefit or the result of the verb, as does the subject, as does Yahweh. So it may sound convoluted and difficult to understand, but and I'm not trying to be fixated here on grammar, just trying to give you the insights that are provided by this stem. What God is saying is that his growth enables our growth, and that we grow when he grows. So by empowering and enriching us, which is what he has said that he is doing on our behalf, that by enriching and empowering his children, by protecting and nurturing us, by adopting us, God grows. So when we come to recognize that growth is necessary for anything to be infinite. The moment something ceases to grow, it ceases to be infinite. The way that God is infinite is that he's always growing. The means to his growth is by empowering our growth. The more he contributes to our well-being, his children's well-being, the covenants, and this is all presented in the context of the covenant now. So the more he contributes to the well-being and to the growth and the enrichment of his children, the more he grows. It's a powerful insight into Yahweh's nature, his what he wants, what he desires, and how he benefits from our participation in the covenant. Now, he says this not only using the hyphal stem, but also writing this in the imperfect conjugation. Now, the imperfect conjugation is also essential, and that it tells us that this is an ongoing situation. And the verb was scribed in the first person singular, affirming that it is God who is doing the growing in this case. But he's doing it with us. F means in association with us. And then he repeats his use of moed, moed, which he used in the previous statement that says that this growth is to the uttermost possible. In capacity, in energy, in capability, in dimensions, and in status. Now, Yahweh has defined the purpose of the covenant from his perspective. Family relationships complete him. Children cause him to grow, to branch out, to blossom and to flourish. In addition, in anticipation of developing a mutually beneficial and engaged relationship with us, God created the universe. That's why he did it. It is the reason we exist. You and I actually provide the means for Yahweh to grow. That is, if we embrace the conditions of the covenant and participate in it, for him to become greater than he already is. Without the covenant, deprived of these relationships, God ceases to be infinite. Loving relationships, a flourishing family, children to nurture, companions to enjoy, a universe to share and to explore with supportive friends represent the only things that God cannot provide for himself, which is why we exist. I don't know if you've been in this situation. I know I have many times. When you see something, experience something, you find something that's extraordinary. If you're like me, the first thing you want to do is to share it. And if you can't share it, the other day, it's a simple thing. I was watching this Super Bowl. My wife's at our East Coast home. And my sons are both, on their own. They're both engaged doing their thing and live midway across the country. And so it's just my pooch and I, and we're sitting here. We're watching the Super Bowl. And out pops just a gorgeous rainbow. And this rainbow is one where the rainbow is huge in the sky. I mean, it's not one of these little thin, wimpy rainbows. We're talking about a gargantuan rainbow. It's drizzling outside, just kind of in a warm drizzle, but the sun is out, and this rainbow is intense, and it's gargantuan. And it comes down the leg that is right in front of me, and this vista that I have from our family room is like it's in our next door neighbor's yard. I mean, it's just magnificent. And so what's my reaction? Go get my camera, my cell phone, and take a picture so I can send it to my wife and to my sons to share it. It was a beautiful sight. Well, the universe is filled with beautiful sights. Now, if you look at some of the pictures taken by Hubble, that's just magnificent sights. And that's at a distance. Imagine exploring some of these beautiful sights up close with the designer. But that's what God wants to share. Creating a beautiful universe, a magnificent universe, and having no one to share it with wouldn't be even remotely as much fun as having someone to share it with. Now, this profound insight tells you an enormous about the nature of God. What he wants, who he is. It is so vastly different from a Lord that wants to be worshipped, to be feared. You know, when a lord in medieval Europe stumbled on a piece of art, for example, he wanted to take it, put it in his own private collection. He didn't want to share it. When they stumbled on a means to be further enriched, it was all for him. That's the nature of lords. Yeah, it's not that way. He's the opposite of that. He's lovable. He's approachable. Because everything that he's ever done, everything that he's ever thought, everything that he has ever offered, he wants to share. And he's come to the realization that we all should have, that the more you give, the more you receive. Particularly when it relates to your children. That is what's being conveyed here, and it is a profound insight in terms of the nature of God. The fruit of the covenant is growth, both ours and God's. our loving and merciful Father grows and is enriched when his family grows and is enriched. It is that simple. It is that profound. Now, we know these things because ma'od is an adverb modifying the verb para, I will be fruitful and grow. Just four statements previously in Bereshit 17:2, ma'od was used to modify rabbah, I will cause you to increase and to grow. And because ma'od was scribed, ma'od, ma'od, in both sentences, God is telling us that the covenant will not only cause us to increase and to grow beyond our wildest imaginations and beyond anything we can possibly even conceive, it will also cause Yahweh to grow to his maximum potential. By helping his children grow, our Heavenly Father grows. Loving family relationships empower and enrich everyone, including God. As with most things, however, relationships can also be painful, even counterproductive. For example, have you ever loved someone who didn't return your love? I don't think I'm the only one in this regard. Have you ever cared about someone who didn't seem to care about you? Now, Larry's on the line. I know, Larry, you were a bodybuilder. You were as tough as nails as a seal. And probably every girl that you ever looked at swooned at your feet. I wasn't gifted that way. And I can recall being enamored with some young ladies that did not share my affection.
I think we've all been in that boat, you know. I mean, I'm not Don Juan, you know, but I've never suffered in that area. But I have loved women that didn't love me back. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I want to tell you, it's infatuated.
I wouldn't say. Well.
Yeah, I would. I knew what you were saying, and I agree with you on that distinction. But it is a debilitating experience, particularly if you get really infatuated with somebody, and they don't want to give you the time of day. It is an extraordinarily debilitating experience, which is why Yahweh chooses not to know those who have chosen not to know him. And he affirms this in the conclusion of his Sermon on the Mount when he says, you know, I do not know you. Get away from me, you who are without the Torah. When we know God, God pays attention to us. Otherwise, he doesn't. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am Yana. We're here with Larry. We're talking about the covenant and aspects of the covenant that are not well known. For example, that it's through our participation in his covenant family that God actually grows. So we bring benefit to God. That's not something that most people are comfortable even thinking about, is it, Larry?
No, and obviously we do it also because we have interest in benefits for ourselves. And that's something else, because they have people have a phony relationship with a God in their mind, mm-hmm. where he just wants to give and give and give and give and give, and nobody gets mm-hmm. anything out of it. You just get free stuff, and relationship is the nature of this beast. I did want to add something, you know, here.
Uh-huh.
You know, and this goes in line with what you were saying earlier. You know, Yahweh's an energy of pure. He's a being of pure energy.
Right.
A spiritual uh-huh. being is.
Correct.
And we now know that moving at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. One sees the past, the present, and the future all simultaneously.
Correct.
You know, and so when he provides us prophecy, it's not so much that he's guessing about what's going to happen. He's just Correct. Reporting on what's already occurred, you know.
Right.
And because he's not caught in the ordinary flow of time, if you will. And so when we hear people tell us they're spiritual, you know, like,
right.
palm readers or astrologers or, you know, these people are not beings of pure energy. They can't do it. And that's why, you know, it's akin to going to a monkey and asking him to throw darts at a board to predict future events, you know.
Yeah, it's astonishing how errant Christianity is. You know, what you're talking about, of course, is the Seventh-day Adventism. And the fact that they have this triune nature for humankind. We're body, we're mind, and we're spirit. Our body is irrelevant from Yahweh's point of view. We do have a physical body. You can talk about it, but it's irrelevant. It's not necessarily good or bad. It's just irrelevant going forward. Excuse me. And that we also have a soul, but they didn't even mention the soul. And they go from there to spirit. And, you know, what in the world would cause them to think that we are a spiritual being? I mean, God never says it, not even remotely.
That's another religious myth. I mean, you know, you see it in a lot of these religions, Ageism especially, where they incorporate Buddhism and everything else, that somehow you're in touch with your spirit.
Yeah, I think this is probably derived from Paul, where Paul begins in Galatians and then continues it throughout his letters, where he has this ongoing Gnostic battle between the flesh and the spirit, and the flesh is bad and the spirit is good. And that... that form of Gnosticism infiltrated itself into Christianity, and therefore there is this Christian myth that being religious is being spiritual, and that the more religious we are, the more spiritual we are. Now, it is true in a way, in the sense that there are two spirits working actively in our world, and one is of the spirit of the adversary. That's why Paul admits that he is demon possessed by the spirit of the adversary in his second letter to the Corinthians. So the benefit of spirit, as you were saying, is it enables God, and this was something else we talked about in that middle hour, it enables God to provide the most detailed eyewitness account of what Yahusha accomplished, body and soul, as well as Yahweh's spirit, accomplished on Pesach, Matzah, and Makkodim. And so if you want an eyewitness account, you'll find it in written 1,000 years before it occurred in Psalm 22, 88, and starting about the 50th chapter of Isaiah. And that is extraordinarily difficult for people to get their arms around until you come to know that as a spiritual being, as light, time simply is. And that as a spiritual being, as light, Yahweh is at any moment and at every moment able to witness our future. And at any moment and every moment able to convey what he has witnessed in our future, in our past. And so prophecies are not predictions. They're eyewitness accounts. They're future history. There's really no difference between his presentation of creation in our past and his presentation of the Magog War, the Islamic War in our future. All comes from the same source in the same way. Be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the nature of Yahweh, particularly as it relates to his covenant and the fact that he says that he grows as his children grow by investing in us. He enriches not only our lives, but his existence. Larry, when we talk about God being light and being spiritual, there would be this, and therefore can witness the past, the present, and future at any moment and present to us, for example, our future and our past so that we know what's going to happen. That implies the idea that God knows everything, that God is everywhere at every time and that knows everything. But that's not true. Yeah, and omniscient. That's just not true.
No, it's not.
No.
And he chooses not to know everybody. I mean, you pointed that out earlier, but, you know, when there's And of course, this also it really is a good example of the hubris of religion. But in the end, according to Yahusha in Matanyahu, they'll say, "But Lord, Lord, didn't we do these great miracles and all these great things and have inspired utterances in your name?" And he'll say, "Well, I never knew you."
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to imagine being around anybody 24 hours a day and not knowing them,
Right. Yeah. So all these Christians that are praying to him constantly, confessing all of their little foibles and asking him for all their special favors and giving him credit for everything that happens in their lives. I mean, being really religious, really spiritual. The truth is, God has no clue who they are. As a matter of fact, doesn't God make? Doesn't He say something about the prayers of those who are without the Torah?
Yeah, what He says is that anybody whose ear is not turned towards the Torah, their prayers are an abomination to Him.
That's
an
correct.
Abomination. So
yeah. So rather than this pray without ceasing, and they have all these wonderful prayers in their churches, and then privately before they go to bed, what God is saying is no. If you don't know me through the Torah, if you're not engaged in this covenant relationship, rather than me just ignoring you and your prayers, you need to know that the reason I have chosen to ignore them is I find them an abomination. And why would God say that? Do you have any idea why God would say that the prayer of a religious person, that's praying on their knees before they go to bed at night, that's praying in their church, is why would he say it's an abomination? I mean, that's pretty strong terms. He's saying that your prayer is an abomination. Why would he say that?
Well, because they're coming at him through a false paradigm, and that paradigm is religion. And they're changing Yahweh's nature. I mean, everything's backwards in religion. It's Yahweh bends down to help us, doesn't he? He's not praying to us. He's not in submission to us. He's helping us. But yet in religion, you're helping him. You're on your, as though he requires your help.
Yeah.
He's not
lifting him up.
Yeah, he's not omnipresent, but one thing he is very brilliant and very powerful.
Right.
And he doesn't need the help of Larry nor Yada in any way, shape, or form.
He wants it. He actually does want it, because he wants us to work with him to share his message and to go off and explore the universe together. So he enjoys our company and our participation and likes to work through people. But in terms of lifting, but in terms of lifting him, in terms of lifting him up, that's, he doesn't need us to lift him up. We need him to lift us up. But in terms of enjoying creation, God definitely wants us to participate with him. But you're right about the paradigm. The reason that the prayer of a religious person is an abomination to God, the reason he doesn't hear them and doesn't know the individual, is they've turned everything upside down. The God that they're praying to is revolting. The God that they're praying to doesn't exist.
He's got issues. He's got issues akin to Joseph Stalin.
Right. Either acquiesce to me and fear me, or I'm going to see to it that that you're obliterated and or punished forever, as would Stalin. I think there's another reason that God views the prayers of the religious as an abomination, and that is because if you are God and you go to all the trouble to create the universe, you go to all the trouble to conceive life, you go to all the trouble to share your plan with humanity, you introduce yourself to humanity, you share your plan, and it is the most magnificent and most generous plan in terms of elevating our status even imaginable. And you're saying, "I am willing to do all of this for you." And you say, piss on that.
Well,
the hell with all of that. I don't even like your Torah. I don't like you as you introduce yourself in your Torah. I think it's all repulsive, this Torah thing that you created. And I don't even like your original covenant, so I'm going to create a new one and a different God. And I'm going to annul everything that you said because I don't like anything that you said. And now I want you to listen to my prayer. Now, under those circumstances, wouldn't you say it's an abomination?
Yeah, I would, but I think it even goes further than that. There's something else, these fellows called prophets, people taking actual literal dictation from Yahweh, They were writing things down. What happened to most of those guys? Most of them were killed.
Right.
I think they sawed Yasha Yu in half. They put Yermai Yu in stocks, and then they threw him in a sewer or a cesspool or something.
They nailed Yasha to an upright pole. After beating him to the near to the point where his physical body gave out because the skin was ripped from the bones.
Yeah, I'm just saying people died to get this message out. It's one thing for somebody to decide or determine that they don't like my opinions or my tone of voice or anything else, but when people died to get that message out, it's an abomination. You want to change it? Step up to the plate, my friend.
And the walk that Yahweh had to walk to enable this, he had to diminish himself to engage with the most repulsive man on the planet at the time, the Pharaoh, who pretended to be God, who was enslaving and abusing his children. And he had to deal with this lowest form of human life. And then he took his children out of that political and militaristic and religious realm, and they go off and they rebel. They go off and they make a golden calf image of a golden bull because of Taurus the bull and the Apis bull cult that was worshipped in Egypt and in Babylon, for that matter. And they make this image. It's just like Christians worshiping on Easter and Christmas, which are all part of that bull worship. Yeah, of Ishtar, of the sun crossing the constellation of Taurus the bull during the vernal equinox, and on that Sunday, that becoming Easter. It's, what do? They were repulsive. Now, can you imagine God would go through all this trouble and your own children, the ones you saved, treat you that way? And then you have humankind creating all of these repulsive religions, and to save them from their religion, you yourself are willing to let your soul go to the place of separation, to be tormented. You're willing to take on physical form and to have man spit at you, all to resolve the problem of sin and rebellion. And then you go through all of that, you lay out that plan and say, here's the walk. It's all presented here, and you have the vast preponderance of humans saying, I don't like any of that. I'm just going to say that it's the gospel of grace and that I've been saved through faith. And then you're going to pray to God, completely ignoring everything he said and did. And you don't think that God's going to look at that as an abomination?
Well, you know, there it is. It's the Masal, or Proverb 28:9. One who turns his ear from hearing the Torah, even his prayer shall be an abomination. Of course it's an abomination. There was too much work, effort, bloodshed, everything else to get that message out. And he proves the message, which even makes it worse. I mean, you know, you can actually look at verifiable evidence. And then at the end of all, the very creation that you want to have the relationship with says, you know what, I'd rather make up a God in my own mind.
Yeah.
And that's really essential.
I'm going to corrupt everything you said. I'm going to rename you. I'm going to call you Jesus Christ and Lord. And then after that, I'm going to ignore everything you taught me in your Torah. I'm going to ignore everything that you've done for me. I'm going to ignore the invitations to meet with you. I'm going to disdain your covenant so much that I'm going to create a new one. And then I want you to listen to what I have to say in my prayer. Come on. I mean, it's why religion, you just want to take the religious and slap them across the, not slapping in a sense of hurting, slapping in a sense of awakening. Like, why on earth would you believe that stuff?
Yeah,
why do you think that your God, you know, I watch the Super Bowl. Russell Wilson, I think, is a great kid. But, you know, everything that happens positive, he's still pointing up to God as if God enabled that to happen. It's just stupid.
Well, the only way that God enabled any of that to happen is that he did creation. But he's certainly not involved in football games.
No, nor in the lives of those who have rejected everything he had to say. And so just because God loves having a relationship with us, just because he's offered us this opportunity to be his children, just because he's enabled our immorality and our perfection and our adoption and our enrichment and our empowerment, doesn't mean that he's going to embrace those who mock him.
One of the things I'd like to throw in here is that Yahweh does not have an inferiority complex.
Yeah.
You know, and it really does take a being with an inferiority complex to make others bow in submission to them. It really does.
Yes.
You know, that's a pointless action. If every time I met somebody, they had me bow in submission to them, do you know how many times I'd want to meet that person?
Well, just to tell me this, if you were speaking of a lord, let's put lords of Europe, for example, the lords during the rule of Roman Catholicism throughout medieval Europe, when a person was bowing down to the lord and submitting to their authority, did that lord ever once say to them that because you have done this, I'm going to enrich you in the extreme and the greatest extent possible?
No, they were just used as tools.
Right.
To
but didn't Yahweh tell his covenant children?
Power.
Didn't he tell his covenant children that my desire through this covenant is to enrich you and to empower you to the greatest extent possible? Doesn't that make our Heavenly Father the antithesis of a Lord? Make the connection. Understand who God is. He's introduced himself to us, and he's made this offer for us to join his family. We'll be back in a moment. So after God tells us that he is going to grow with us, and in the extreme and to the greatest extent possible, his next statement is also interesting. He says, "And I will provide and give this." Now he's speaking of the benefits of the covenant. Two here is law, which means to approach people from different races and places, Goyim, and then royal rulers, Malachim, will come forth from you. And he's speaking, of course, to Abraham. So there's two things here that are interesting. First is most Christians view the covenant, the first covenant, as something that God created with the Jews, so that their new covenant is something that he created with them. And yet he's talking about this original covenant with the original guy that he founded the covenant with being for Goyim, for people from different races and places.
Wow. That sure blows a lot of myths right out of the water.
Yeah, it sure does, doesn't it? Why, you know, you don't need to have a new testament and a new covenant for the Gentile church when God is saying here, I'm providing all of this to people from different races and places.
Well, you would need something totally separate for a church because he never has anything to do with such a religion.
That, of course, is true. I was just focusing on going from, the Christian mythology is that of replacement theology where the Christian church replaced all the promises that were given to the Jews. Well, this renders that premise, which is false for lots of reasons, not to mention that God doesn't have a church, and God is not into replacing anything. But it says right here that the benefits of the covenant are for people from different races and places, Goyim. Now, the second part of this, I think, is quite interesting. And you'd have to think about, what in the world is God talking about? And royal rulers will come forth from you. Okay, so if you look at Abraham, in terms of his direct descendants, he has Yishak, Laphter, and Ishmael. And with Ishmael, God specifically rejects him for participating in the covenant. He fades off into oblivion. With Yishak gives birth to Jacob, and Jacob becomes Yisrael. But in terms of kings, royalty of Yisrael, of united Yisrael, you've really only got a couple of them. I mean, for the most part, you've got a couple of them, and then the whole thing just disintegrates. And the two are Dode and Solomon after him, and Solomon wasn't much of a winner. And so to say that you're going to have, you know, royalty coming forth from you, boy, that's not much of a promise, because really all you got is dough that was worth mentioning. And yeah. So he's not talking about Israel here. And for him to say that this gift is for Goyim, which is non-Israel. Now, Israel is a subset of Goyim. You know, Goyim is all people from different races and places. And Israel is a specific group of people. So they would be a subset of it. But Goyim, for the most part, is used to differentiate from Israel. So you're really not in a position to say here that God is talking about that the royal rulers here are going to be kings of Israel. So what is he talking about here? Well, if there is a sovereign, God doesn't really present himself very often as sovereign, but if there is a royal ruler of the universe, who would it be?
That'd be Yahweh. Yeah.
Okay. So if Larry accepts the terms and conditions of the covenant and is adopted into Yahweh's family, who's his father?
That same guy. Same
guy.
Same entity.
Okay. Now, if you're an heir to the royal power, if you will, the authority of the universe, what does that make you?
Oh, that makes me royal, too.
Yeah, there you go. So when he's talking about this from a familial point of view, that the covenant being family, and he talks about the benefits of the covenant being inherited, do you suppose that maybe that is what he's talking about? He says, and royal rulers will come forth from you? As he's,
yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what he means there. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it is just one of these places where we just have to think our way through the presentation and think, okay, could he be talking about kings of a earthly domain? Well, no. So what is he talking about? Well, why don't we raise our sights just as he did with Abraham's, where he took him to heaven and showed him the light of the stars and said, this is your inheritance. All we need to do is what Larry has just done. Raise our sights. Big picture. Understand what the covenant is, what the gift is. And we will be in a position to capitalize upon it. We'll be back with you tomorrow. May God bless.